Hi, and welcome back to Uncited, the internet's least reliable English lit podcast. I'm Chantel.
And I'm Amy.
And I have a peer review. I actually have a number of peer reviews. So many peer reviews.
We have a lot of oh shit reviews.
So last week we talked about The Lady of Shalott by Alfred Tennyson. And I don't know what I was doing. I had coffee that day. I don't know what was going on with me. First of all, we talked about Plato's cave and I said Pluto's cave and I did it twice. So it's not like it was just a slip of the tongue. I think I legitimately thought it was called Pluto's cave temporarily. Plato's cave is, you know, the thing where there's someone in a cave and they can only see shadows and they think that's the whole world that the philosopher Plato came up with. Pluto's cave is a little hole in the rock that the dog from Mickey Mouse found.
Isn't that much better than Plato? Like, Pluto is a cute dog. Plato is an old white guy.
I have a problem bringing up Pluto from Mickey Mouse because he's a dog, but then Goofy is also a dog. So what does that mean?
Well, thank you for joining us today on Uncited. We're going to go have an existential crisis.
Okay, so then I also missed the Rapunzel intertextuality. I don't know how I did that. It was written in like the 1830s, I think, and Rapunzel was written in 1812. So she's like a woman stuck in a tower and she can't come down. Obviously Rapunzel. I watched Tangled right after we did this episode.
And you were like slapped in the face with it?
Yeah, it just like punched me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Kind of like how I looked up Lord Tennyson's biography on Wikipedia and I went, Chantel, how the fuck did we miss that he was an influence on the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood?
Yeah, I actually wrote that down because he sent it to me. Tennyson's early poetry with its medieval and powerful visual imagery was a major influence on the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. I don't really get that because I've seen Dante Gabriel Rossetti's art. And I would not say that the little heart baby is powerful imagery.
Yeah, well, remember, there is more than Dante Gabriel Rossetti in that group of people.
That's true.
Not that he would let anybody else think that, but we know it.
There's the guy who did the Ophelia painting.
Yeah.
Which is actually good, and I didn't realize it was Pre-Raphaelite.
Which is also kind of Lady of Shalott.
Oh, God damn it, Amy. You're right. If you want to hear us talk more about the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, you can listen to our first episode on Christina Rossetti, my homegirl. And my dear partner, Ethan, pointed out that the Lady of Shalott's curse just said she couldn't look upon Camelot. Why was she living right next to Camelot? Just move.
Well, because she's a lady stuck in a tower.
I mean, was she stuck in the tower? Because as soon as the curse was broken, she just came down from the tower. So I think she could have come down from the tower the whole time. She was just staying there voluntarily so as not to invoke the curse.
She could have done like that Sandy Bullock movie and just worn a like blindfold or whatever.
Yeah, like Bird Box.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, it's Bird Box. They put a bird in a box.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all our numerous peer reviews for the week.
I have another one. I said I have Ulysses on my bookshelf, and then I was sitting on the couch looking at my bookshelf, and I went, "No, I have Ulysses by James Joyce on my bookshelf."
Ah, that makes sense.
To which I then learned there are too many Ulysses.
I was also a little confused because I thought Ulysses was a modernist text, but it makes sense that there are two. Yeah, James Joyce, that tracks.
So here we are. We're not perfect. We're pretty unreliable, but we do talk about our mistakes and learn from them.
I have some shout outs also.
Shout outs. That's great. Love that for us.
We're really behind on shout outs. We need to shout out our good friend Dustin on Sandman Stories Presents because he's so awesome and he gave us the best shout out on his podcast. I love Sandman Stories Presents. It's like one of the only things I can do when I'm having anxiety brain at night and my thoughts won't stop spinning and I just turn on Dustin's voice and it's like boom, relax mode. You can hear Amy's voice also coming up on his podcast with a little thank you and good night in French. And Words About Books is making bingo cards for like things that Ben thinks Nate is going to say in the episode, which I'm playing along with, you know, playing bingo as they do the episode, yeah. Obviously. And they're like so many steps ahead of us when it comes to make fun of your co-host department. So I think we need to step up our game.
Okay, cool, cool, cool. I mean, we make fun of other podcasters instead.
That's true. That's true. We're like two against the world. wild.
Like, how many episodes in a row can Amy mention Glenn? We'll see.
I think every episode. I just cut it out usually.
Guess who's editing today? I do have a shout out. It's a podcast called Podcast Recorte Verbal. I probably mispronounced that. It is a podcast that looks through educational material and promotes basically literary readings. And they shouted out our Virginia Woolf episode this week.
So, oh, wow. That's awesome.
You can find them on Instagram, to my knowledge, at recorteverbal.cast. It's a Portuguese language podcast that talks about educational literary reviews and stuff.
Excellent. I have a clean language for us today.
That's not how that works, but okay.
It's Chantel's Clean Language. Clean Language with Chantel, a segment that we've always done every week forever. And if you think that I have never done it, you are insane.
Call me loony.
Toonie, for your thoughts. I went to the dentist that Amy likes.
Yeah, I love the dentist. Not your dentist, my dentist, but also not just my dentist. I like dentists.
I haven't been to the dentist since I moved.
So a year.
Which was like a year and a half.
Okay.
It was a little bit before that. So it was probably like maybe 2.5 years since I've been to the dentist. And I went in and they were like, when was the last time you were at the dentist? And I was like, 2020. And then the hygienist had to like leave and hyperventilate in the break room for a little bit and then come back. And then the dentist checked my teeth and he was like, oh, you have excellent hygiene. Anyway, that's my fun little humble brag. My thing is, despite having like brushing every day and stuff, my teeth will never go back to their prime of their life because of a very short period of time when I was using charcoal toothpaste. I don't know why they have this as an option. Charcoal is like the most abrasive substance known to humanity, but don't use charcoal toothpaste because it will heck up your enamel.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my clean language. Cleaning yourself language.
Personal hygiene with Chantel.
Yes.
I have bad enamel because I eat lemons like they're apples.
It's unhinged how you eat lemons. Amy cuts up a lemon, pours salt on it, and then just eats the lemon.
It's a virgin tequila shot.
That's lime. What a good time. What a good time. Okay, are we ready to talk about a work of text?
I mean, I guess we can, but full disclosure, I didn't do my homework. I didn't realize that we were actually going to be talking about this this week. I thought we were just going to like fuck around and find out. But here we are. I didn't do my homework. I have read this, I think, at some point in my life, but who knows?
That's fine because I did do my homework and I didn't show up to the recording and say, what are we talking about today? And then say, oh no, I didn't read that. I made notes, so we're good. Today we're talking about The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. This is something that I was thinking of. I thought that we had talked about recording on the podcast, but the only reason I had it in my head actually was because I met someone last summer, which to me is recently because I never go out, who had like a stanza from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner tattooed on their leg. And I was like, that's really cool. You're an English major. We should talk about The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And then I just filed that away in my subconscious for like 9 months.
Yeah, I think last week on the pod, we talked about how we should cover it at some point in time. And I was like, yeah, that could be fun. And then I didn't bring it up. And now we're here.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge, we talked about a little bit last week. He was contemporaries with Tennyson, not temporaries with Contennison. He seemed like an all right dude. I couldn't find anything really weird about him. He was alive from 1772 to 1834. He lived in England. He struggled with anxiety and depression throughout his life, and some people think that he actually had bipolar disorder, but as we all know, they were really bad at mental health back then, so they didn't diagnose things. He also had physical health issues because of all his childhood illnesses that he had, and then the treatments for all those illnesses gave him a lifelong opium addiction. So he was just dealing with a lot of stuff. He also had like a lot of trauma because he had dealt with the death of his father really early on. So just all around, he was not having a good time.
We should have him on the pod. He could talk about his therapy with us.
I'm sure he would love to have therapy.
Let's get this guy on the pod.
Imagine how much we would have skipped the Victorian era if they just had therapy back then.
They repressed so we could go to therapy.
He loved reading when he was young, and so he based his whole career around like different aspects of literature. He was a literary critic, and he wrote a lot of analysis. His most popular analysis is about Shakespeare. So he's just like us.
Yeah, I think most of the work that I've done with Coleridge was from his, like, literary criticism.
That tracks. Yeah. Our most popular literary analysis is also from Shakespeare.
That's a trend.
Shakespeare really likes to make a name for other people. He was also a writer, obviously. That's what we're talking about today. He founded the Romantic movement with his friend William Wordsworth, which, if you've ever heard that name, you know that's a writer's name, because that's the most writer name that's ever existed in the whole universe. His two best known works are The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which we're talking about today, obviously, and Kubla Khan, which I have not read.
I don't think I have either.
I think it's about a Mongolian warrior, I think.
That would make sense.
So The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, you have read, right?
I have at some point in time, yes.
At some point in time. Do you remember anything about it?
There's an albatross?
Yes, there is an albatross.
That's what I remember from it.
Fabulous. Okay, I can catch you up a little bit. It's a lyric poem, just, you know, carrying on our theme from last week. It's Coleridge's longest poem. The Mariner's Tale starts with him on a ship. A mariner's like a sailor. They leave, and then a storm blows them to a land of snow, and they get stuck in the ice. Now, the summary that I read said that they get stuck in the South Pole. I don't think there's actually anything that says in the poem that it is the South Pole, but that does track, because there were a lot of, like, explorer myths around the South Pole at this time, and Edgar Allan Poe, around the same time that this was written, wrote a really racist novel, which was his only novel, about someone going to the South Pole and finding a people there. An albatross shows up while they're stuck in the ice and breaks through the ice, and a new wind picks up and they sail forward.
I mean, this all tracks if we're talking about, like, weird deserted lands, because Coleridge and Mary Shelley were, like, known to each other.
Does Mary Shelley have stuff about weird deserted lands?
Well, I mean, Frankenstein mentions the Rime of the Ancient Mariner multiple times, and it opens with a really, like, deserted polar expedition.
Oh, you're right. Oh my god, I forgot about that. Jeez Louise. This is actually a frame narrative as well, just like Frankenstein.
Here we are.
The frame narrative is that the old sailor is stopping a wedding guest to tell him this story. And this is the story he's telling him. And it's interrupted every once in a while when we get, like, glimpses of what's happening at the wedding reception.
Right.
And also if the wedding guest gets too freaked out by the story and is like, hold up, I need a second. Like, what's going on? Yeah, that makes sense that they're both frame narratives and they both happen on, like, a weird deserted ice thing. And weird supernatural stuff is going on. That totally makes sense. The albatross comes back every day after breaking the ice to hang out with the crew. The crew's really happy that he's there. They take him as, like, a good omen. Until our narrator has to be a douche canoe and just shoots him. So the other sailors are upset at first, but then the fog clears and the ship keeps sailing and they change their tune. They're like, oh, we thought that the albatross was bringing the wind, but actually maybe the albatross was bringing the fog and the mist, and it was a bad albatross. No, they're all dumb. And then the ship lets out on a huge calm sea. I think that this is not just a language thing, because he says that there's crawling creatures all over the sea. I think there actually are. And the wind stops and they get stuck there. So they're stuck there and there's water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. And they all start dehydrating. Everyone's super thirsty and angry. And they're blaming the mariner because he took away the albatross who was providing the wind. So they hang the dead albatross around his neck as a sign of shame. And then a ship appears. And the mariner sees the ship first, but he's so thirsty that he can't speak. So he bites his own arm, drinks the blood so that he can wet his throat enough to yell that there's a ship approaching, and everyone's like, woo! And the ship comes, and then they're like, oh, woo! Oh, no! Because it's actually a ghost ship. And there's two women on board, and those women are Death and Life in Death. They're playing dice and they're gambling over the mariner's life. Life in Death wins. So all the other crew start dropping down dead, glaring at the mariner, and their stares last for the whole rest of the trip. So just the whole rest of the story, just imagine that they're still, like, their dead bodies are glaring at him.
Just like Jim from The Office, just staring at you.
Yeah, stares directly into the mariner's eyes like I'm Jim from The Office. He is the only one left. The narrator now cannot die. He is stuck on the ship for, I believe, 7 more days, not able to drink, not able to pray, not able to die, until he realizes, whoa, epiphany, maybe we should respect other beings on the earth. Except he does it in a religious way. He's like, all God's creatures should be treated with respect. And with this realization, the albatross breaks off from his neck and sinks into the sea. Then the other sailors' bodies rise. He believes that they're reanimated by like an angelic force, and they steer the ship back out of the sea. No wind still. It's just magic wind.
Okay.
And through the ice and back toward home, and they just are doing stuff, but I think still glaring at him. But there's also angels inside them.
Right.
And then they get home, and the mariner sees the angelic figures leave the dead bodies. They're all standing over the dead bodies, and then they like rise up into the sky, and then he sees another ship approaching, and his ship sinks with all the dead bodies on it. And so he gets rescued, wakes up on the other boat with a pilot, the pilot's boy, and a hermit, who is like a religious figure who prays all the time. The people who rescued him think he is the devil, and they're like, oh, what are we gonna do? And they're like frozen, so he like rows them back to shore, and they're like, the devil can row, what's going on? And he then tells the hermit his story, and we find out that he's compelled to tell his story again and again every single day. He knows when he needs to tell it because he'll start feeling a pain, and if he doesn't tell it, the pain just gets worse and worse. He knows who he's supposed to tell it to, and this day, it was supposed to be the wedding guest. So he's like doomed to wander these lands looking for the person he's supposed to tell his story to each day, and his moral that like all God's creatures should be respected.
Right.
And then each person who hears his story comes out of it a little sadder and wiser. What do you think? First thoughts?
How dumb do you have to be to shoot something that metaphorically is good fortune? Like, I just... what was the point? And then you get your just desserts, you know?
Do you know what I think it is? I think it's like that part of human nature is like really terrible, but also not uncommon. Like I can see so many people that I've heard out in the world being like, eh, this bird's eating our food. Eh, it's just a bird. Why is everyone so happy about this dumb bird and like shooting the bird, you know?
I had a cardinal earlier today. I think I have a red winter coat. I think it mistook me for one of its own because it was mad at me or flirting with me. One or the other. That's usually how it goes for people as well when it comes to me. And like, I stood there and I looked at it because I thought it was a fascinating creature. And I don't know how people don't, you know? And like, I saw these birds on this like street lamp, and they were making a nest, and I wanted them to not be there for their own safety, not because I didn't want them to be there. And I just like, I don't understand how you could think anything other. Like, yes, I am weary that like, you know, hawks will attack pets, and that's not fantastic, right? But you can protect your pet from that, right? Like there's a certain like nature happens thing or whatever. But like,
yeah, people get so annoyed with like animals just being animals, but like, we're just being animals too. I actually looked up if Coleridge had like opinions on animal protection, because it's very obvious. It's like that message punches you in the face, which I like. I like that about it. But I looked up if he was a vegetarian, and it said he did dabble in vegetarianism. Obviously, it was before like anyone knew anything about nutrition, so he didn't stick with it. But yeah, it was something he tried.
Well, for the longest time, he was also like a political radical, so that kind of checks out too.
And he was also pretty religious and spiritual throughout his life, so the religious messaging that punches you in the face also tracks with him. His dad was an Anglican preacher, I think, and then he was like, he believed that everyone has like their own personal spirituality, and the truth of God's existence can be found in your inner life and also in nature. And then at the end of his life, he went back to being Anglican. But yeah, he was religious and he liked animals. So that all tracks with this poem. I love this poem. I love it so much. I think it's really good. I think I could do personally without like the religious symbolism, but it's like way ahead of its time with the all lives have value message.
Well, not just that, but also the like, your actions have repercussions. Like his entire fucking ship dies because of him.
Yeah. I don't think that was ahead of its time, though, like Hamlet exists. But yeah, that Fair. Is a really important message.
But like, I mean, you know, yes, all God's creatures are important. He's like, you know, this bird was great. But like, also, dude, you are directly responsible for the death of an entire crew.
I don't know why, like, life and death decided to punish him for the albatross's death by killing these other people who didn't have anything to do with it. Because they're punishing the other people more than him, personally, I think.
Yeah, it's some weird, like, survivor's guilt mechanism, which is very, you know, Christian and stuff.
That's true. Guilt is a big thing. The poem was really popular obviously. It's still really popular. Albatross around the neck has become like a saying. It's not a common saying, but it is a saying to mean like carrying the heavy burden of guilt. But an albatross is a real bird though.
They are a bird. They're a large seabird, range from the South Ocean and the North Pacific. They are absent from the North Atlantic, though fossil remains show they once occurred there.
They can fly very far, which is why they are the airplane service in The Rescuers.
And they do not seem to be on the vulnerable list, so there's that.
Awesome.
On the Wikipedia pages for albatrosses, there's this culture part where albatross have been described as the most legendary of all birds. Obviously, here they represent the innocence and beauty of God's creation in the poem we just read. Widespread myth holds that sailors believe shooting or harming an albatross is disastrous.
That makes sense.
Partially because of the poem, but in truth, sailors regularly ate them, as reported by James Cook, who were allowed to hate in 1772.
Oh no.
Some people thought that the albatrosses were the souls of the lost sailors, so you shouldn't kill them. It seems very hit or miss, but it was also talked about in a French poem by Charles Baudelaire in his poem, The Albatross. So that's fun. In non-European mythologies, if I can just add, the Maori use the wing's bones to make flutes. In Hawaiian mythology, albatrosses are considered being a sacred manifestation of ancestors. And in Japanese mythology, they are thought of as a fool bird due to its habit of disregarding terrestrial predators, making it easy prey for feather collectors. And that was your culture with Amy.
They're so big, they don't need to be afraid of anything until they do. They're very large. Very, very large. So I have some readings. The religious symbolism, obviously, punches you in the face. He says all God's creatures, great and small, need to be respected. He says those who respect all beings, like, pray better and are more connected to God. But then there's, like, I think you could do a little deep dive into all the other stuff. So there's killing the albatross is the first thing that plunges them into turmoil.
Yeah.
In the Christian Bible, murder is the original sin. And then the albatross gets hung around his neck as an identifiable mark of his guilt. Somewhat like the mark of Cain, you would say.
Ooh, because he's killing a fellow sailor, like a fellow brother in the sea.
Some might say.
Some.
Then he's forced to suffer for his sin. Sin is a big thing.
Yep.
And then he repents by realizing what he did wrong and being sorry for it. And then the albatross falls from his neck into the ocean and cleanses him like a baptism. And then he's forced to tell people his story every day as if he were proselytizing.
Right.
That's an obvious reading I could do with out it personally, but my preferred reading is like a non-religious one. I couldn't find this anywhere, so I just made it up. But I think it could also be like about the evils in human nature. Like most of the sailors are in harmony with the albatross, but it only takes one person to doom them all. So just like I believe generally most people have good intentions, but then one person in power can create a whole system that feeds into their greed and cruelty. So like if we look at today, that would be like the corporate class is the one holding the crossbow, you know, burning the rainforest down.
One bad apple.
Then they all went along with it right after that and it doomed everybody. So that's my non-religious reading of it. And I think it's like being a selfish jerk is not that uncommon. And I think meaningless cruelty is like an unfortunately common part of human nature. And I think it's a commentary on that.
I like it.
On a scale of having a beautiful albatross bring your wind to sail you around the South Pole every day to having to wander the earth on foot telling your dreary story to random people, what would you rate this book? This poem.
So is the first part a 10 and then the last part is a 1?
Yeah.
Okay, so we reverse scale than what we usually do.
Yeah.
Okay, for the folks at home. I think like being at the beach and hanging out with some seagulls.
Okay.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of religious allegory and we don't really need it, right? But, like, birds are pretty neat. And being at the beach is pretty neat. And this poem is pretty neat. So that's where I'm at. What about you?
I think I would rate it, like, just leaving harbor at the beginning when you're full of hope for your journey ahead, only for it to be dashed. Because I think it's a really cool poem. I think that it has also been hyped up a lot. So if you go into it not knowing what it is and you find out it's like a very, very, very long poem with so much happening after the albatross is gone, you might be a little bit disappointed. But I think overall, it's like very, I love this poem. I think it's a really good poem. And I think that there's a lot to sink your teeth into with the like imagery and analysis and stuff. Cool. I think that's it for us today. If you like this episode, please give us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps other people find our show. And we thank you for listening. If you would like to talk to us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at UncitedPod. So we will be there. And until then, we hope to see you in 2 weeks.
And as always, we're excited, unavailable. But it's okay. I'm editing. I'm pulling my weight this week.
You are. You're doing the best. I love you.